If you're visiting with us for the first time, welcome. You've kind of jumped in the middle of a marathon here, so I hope that you're able to pick some up out of the class. We are studying the first eight chapters of the book of Romans. We're in our second semester or quarter, and who only the Lord knows if we'll get through even eight chapters in 6 months. So let's crank up. We're in Romans chapter 4. And from Romans chapter 1, verse 18 to 3:20, the conclusion of that section is in verse 28 of chapter 3. It is a summary of everything that has been taught. And before I read that, let me say that what we're looking at is two different ways that a person can be made righteous. The first one is what? By law. And Galatians chapter 3 says, if you're going to be declared right, for everyone who seeks to be declared righteous by law, there's a curse. So what's the curse that you need to be aware of if you're going to stand before God and be judged by law? What's the curse?
The law only condemns you.
Okay. Cursed is he that continues not in everything written in the book of the law to do it. You got to do it all. You got to do it all the time. You got to do it all the time perfectly. You got to do it all the time perfectly, and you can never make one single mistake. James says, if a man keeps the whole law and offends in one point, he's guilty of all of it. So there's a curse. But if you want to be declared righteous by law, and you can live your entire life and never transgress law one time, then you can go knock on the doors of heaven and say, let me come in. And there won't be anything to keep you out. Because the only thing that keeps one out of heaven is what? Sin. And if you've never transgressed law, you have never what? Sin, right? Everybody with me yet? Trying to get everybody's mind gathered up here, okay? Because we've got lots of things going on in our lives. So the first chapter 1, verse 18 through chapter 3, verse 20 is trying to investigate all the ways that we can possibly be saved by law. And there have been some good men that tried. And good women that tried. And guess what the outcome is? Chapter 3 says what? For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. There is none righteous, not even one. No one. No one. No one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing law. All these and many, many more phrases. Verse 28 is the conclusion of this section. Chapter 3, verse 28. For we maintain that a man is justified by faith apart from observing law. Not just the law. The word the is not there in the text. We maintain that a man is justified by faith apart from observing law. Our salvation is either by law or it is by faith. It is either earned or it is imputed. And now he has sufficiently gone through the concept of trying to be justified by law that we get to the point that we find out nobody is going to be declared righteous in his sight before by keeping law. Nobody. Because we've all sinned. And so that conclusion is going to now spring into chapter 4. And 2 weeks ago, we started into 4. And he says, remember, here's his premise, and he's going to build on that. The premise is, the conclusion of this section becomes the premise for the next section. For we maintain that a man is justified by faith apart from observing law. And so now, let's see if we can prove that. Let's get some evidence of that. And chapter 4... And we gave an outline last time. It's talking about Abraham's righteousness, and you can put in parenthesis imputed righteousness. We've been talking about law righteousness, earned righteousness, and now we're going to talk about imputed righteousness. It's a completely different concept. You've got to put everything that you know about being good enough and earning it and keeping law, you've got to put all that right over here. And now you've got to help clear your mind, because what we did in chapter 1, verse 18 through 3:20 is we came in and we bulldozed your house down. I mean, whatever hope you had and whatever house you had built about, okay, I can only be this much righteous and God's going to take care of the rest of it for me. You know, this is my works and what I deserve plus God's grace is going to get me to heaven. Whatever you held along that line, he bulldozed that down for you. And you better let it go. If you hold on to it, then you're going to be in a world of hurt when you stand before God. I mean, it's important. It's imperative that you let it go. And, you know, some of us along the way, we just kept reducing the amount that we could earn in our mind. And at one time we said, you know, I can only be, make it up here to 80%. And God's going to have to take care of 20% of this for me because I just can't be righteous, you know. And then as we learn more about ourselves, then we drop that down to about 50%. And we say, you know, I can't even be 80% righteous all the time. So I can only be about 50% righteous. And then as we grew, we dropped that on down until maybe we got that down to 10%. But you got to let your 10% go. You're not even 10% righteous. And neither am I. You're 0% righteous. You're minus. You're in a minus column of righteousness. And your salvation is either by grace through faith or it's by works of law. It is not a combination of both of them. Now, that's a hard thing for those of us that grew up with that concept. It's hard for us to let that go because that was our security. And if you're going to come and take my security away, I mean, you may look at my shack, you may look at my house that I live in and say, that's pretty sorry. That's a pretty ugly looking shack you live in. Well, you're probably right, but it's the only one I got. So you better watch what you do to it. And if you come plow it under, you better have something better for me. Or I'm going to fight you. I'm going to stop you from trying to take my house down. You understand what I'm saying? And that's exactly the concept that we struggle with. Because you look at somebody else's house and you say, boy, that's pretty pathetic. And you might be right. But if it's all they got, they're going to fight for it. And so you better be knowing that if you're going to take something, you don't have a right just to come knock somebody's house down. If you're going to take something away from somebody, you have something better for them. The Lord does. But you've got to know before you'll ever understand and accept imputed righteousness, you've got to know you can't earn it yourself. You've got to know that. So, now he said, we maintain a man is justified by faith apart from observing law. Now, let's get some evidence of that. Abraham's righteousness. And here's the sum total of chapter 4. Was Abraham's righteousness earned or was it imputed? That's the whole point of chapter 4. And he's going to take one thing at a time that the Jews of his day, the Jewish Christians even, would have trusted in. And he's going to take that away from them. And he says, what shall we say that Abraham, our forefather, discovered in this matter? And then he sets up this next discussion. If Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about. Not before God, he puts that in there. But if he was justified by works, he has something to brag about. But what does the Scripture say? The Scripture says Abraham believed God and it was credited to him for righteousness. When was it credited to him? Was it credited to him before or after he was circumcised? Before. If it was credited to him before he was circumcised, then what do we know? It wasn't because of circumcision that he was justified. Right? You all with me? That's what he's showing right here. And so, he says in verse 11, he received circumcision as a sign, and he's going to go ahead and tell you, since he told you what it wasn't, what it didn't accomplish, he's going to tell you what it was for. In verse 11, here's why he was circumcised. As a sign and seal of the righteousness he had, past tense, by faith, while he was still uncircumcised. He was already circumcised whenever the Bible says he was declared righteous. So if you want the context there, it is in Genesis chapter 15, verse 6, that you first encounter the phrase that God saw his faith and he counted it as righteousness. And then it is in chapter 17 that he was circumcised. And so if you want the chronology of it to write it out there, it's in chapter 15. He was already declared righteous. In chapter 17, circumcision came on the scene.
Ken?
Yeah.
Was that only true of Abraham?
No. In fact, I love it when this is exactly, he's going to say, let's see, in the last part of this, he's going to say it was the words that was credited to him was not written for him only, but for us also who believe. And then he goes, watch what he says here. Where is it? Let me get it. Okay, look at verse, I've written over it, so what is the verse here? Verse 9. Is this blessedness only for the circumcised or for the uncircumcised? Why would I ask that question? Because we have been saying that Abraham's faith was credited as righteousness. Abraham would be representative of the circumcised, right? So that is exactly the question that has to be asked. Then, since Abraham and those who were like him, since they were justified in this way, what about those that were not like him? What about the Gentiles? Is this just for Abraham? Or is it for Abraham and his people? Or is it for Abraham and his people and anybody else? And the answer is what? It's for everybody. And that's what he's going to show here. Verse 11, he received circumcision as a sign and seal of the righteousness he already had by faith while he was still uncircumcised. So he is a father of, look who? All who believe but have not been circumcised in order that righteousness might be credited to them, imputed to them. He is also the father of the circumcised, who are not only the circumcised, but who walk in the footsteps of the faith our father Abraham had before he was circumcised. So he is the father of whom? All who have faith, whether Jew or Gentile, whether circumcised or uncircumcised. Right? So this blessing that we saw here in verse 7 and 8, blessed is the man whose offenses have been forgiven, his sins covered. Blessed is the man whose sins the Lord will never count against him. This blessing is available to whom? All of Abraham's descendants. And that would be whom? Everybody who walks by faith, whether circumcised or uncircumcised. That's his point. So Abraham's righteousness is by faith and not by works of law. Now, the second part here is independent of circumcision in verse 9 through 12. We just got that part. And now, in verse 13 through 22, it is also independent of what? Moses' law. Now, that should be a self-evident truth if you know your chronology. Why? Abraham lived and died before Moses' law was given. So you pretty well know what? He didn't have to keep Moses' law in order to be justified, did he? Because it wasn't there, right? I mean, but why would he spend so much time doing this? Because you've got Jews, a lot of Jews who are Christians, and they're saying, hey, I like this justification by grace through faith, but let's get one thing straight. You got to be circumcised. And so you Gentiles, didn't they chase Paul around? And weren't they all angry, the Jewish Christians from Jerusalem? Weren't they angry at him because they were chasing him around to these Gentile places and they were saying, you got to be circumcised before you can be a Christian? And that's what the Jerusalem conference was about in chapter 15 after he came back from his second missionary journey and these people had followed him around everywhere telling these Gentiles, you got to be circumcised, you got to be circumcised, you got to be circumcised. And so Paul brought a young man with him to Jerusalem in Acts chapter 15, and he stood this uncircumcised young man up before him who was a Christian. He said, okay, here's the test case, guys. And he's before the elders and the apostles in Jerusalem. He said, you going to make this boy be circumcised before he can be saved? And all of a sudden, it came out of just words. Now you got to make a decision here. Are you going to make this young man be circumcised before he can be a Christian? And so they had to debate about this in Acts 15, and you're several years removed from Acts chapter 2, and that's always been an interesting thing to me. But they made the decision what? No. We can't bind that. We can't bind that. So he's teaching that here in Rome, and by the way, that didn't settle the problem, because these epistles are written after this. Galatians is written after this. I mean, these Judaizers from Jerusalem who wanted to enforce Moses' law on circumcision, they didn't make them quit. Hopefully, some of them it did, but there were others who just were hell-bent to get this done. And so they pursued Paul his whole life. Okay, then it's independent of Moses' law, and let's start reading here in 13. It was not through law, not only the law, it was not through law that Abraham and his offspring received the promise. That's pretty obvious that it wasn't through Moses' law, right? Because Moses' law didn't exist. But he says it was not through law that Abraham and his offspring received the promise. And highlight or underline or circle or something other to make jump out to you in your text the word the promise. He's going to start talking about a promise. He's going to pick it up in verse 14. He's going to say the promise. In verse 16, he's going to say the promise. In verse 20, he's going to say the promise. In the last part of verse 21, he's going to say the promise. So he's going to start talking about a promise that God made. And his point that he's going to make is, all these blessings that God gave, who you need, Gary? Okay, so he's going to make this whole section right here, he's going to start talking about a promise. And the Jews had always felt like the blessings that God had promised them were contingent upon the law that came through the law. And he's going to say those blessings that God promised didn't come through the law. They never did come through the law. They came because God gave you his word. God gave you a promise. And so he says, it was not through law that Abraham and his offspring received the promise that he would be heir of the world. But through what? The righteousness that comes by faith. That's always been the thread. It's all, justification was, in Abraham's time, came from a promise, not to those who kept the law, but those who what? Had faith. Those who trusted God. And when God saw that trust, he said, that's a righteous man. I'm going to put righteousness in his bank account. And where did God get righteousness? It's his righteousness. His very own righteousness. And he's going to give that to you as a gift. And so if there were some way that you could receive God's very own righteousness, would you feel some security in your life for the first time? I hope so, because that's exactly what God's offering you. And you can stand before God and be just as righteous as God is. That's not heresy, folks. That's gospel. I mean, anything short of that is not righteousness. God's not playing a game. And he's not saying, well, if your righteousness is about 80%, I'm going to let you in. If you're about 80% good, I'm going to let you in. It's not there. When you stand before God, either you're not going to have one single sin charged against you, or you're not going to heaven. You got that? There will be no sin in heaven. And if you stand before God and you got one single sin charged against you, you ain't getting in. Now, I'm not going to be able to reach that goal. Are you? I done messed up. Do you understand? I've already sinned, and I can't do anything about it. And we've got this little thing of, you know, walking the aisle and getting our sins forgiven, and we'll say, Lord, forgive me since I last stood justified in your sight. What in the world do we mean? So we get forgiven from prayer to prayer, right? And if we get killed halfway in between the prayer, we just missed out. Boy, that's not much confidence, is it? That's not much security. I like that where it says, blessed are they whose offenses have been forgiven, whose sins have been covered, and the Lord will never count his sin against him. I like that. Don't you? Man, that's what I want. Take care of my past, my present, and my future for me. And how does he do that? By giving you his righteousness. It wasn't through the law that Abraham and his offspring received the promise he'd be heir of the world, but it was through righteousness that comes by faith. For if those who live by law are heirs, faith has no value and the promise is worthless. Ain't that right? I mean, you got to make a choice here. You can't have it all. You can't have a little of your righteousness and a little of God's righteousness, a little bit that comes by law and a little bit that comes by faith. You can't have that. That's not an option. He says, if those who live by law are heirs, faith has no value, the promise is worthless. And look at verse 15. Because law brings wrath. You understand that? Any of you ever had the struggle within yourself that you want to do what's right and you tried and you promised God if he'll forgive you, you won't ever do that again? You ever had that before? And so you assume God forgave you since you begged him, and then the next thing that happened was what? You did it again. And you say, well, God, I know I promised you if you'd give me one more chance, I wouldn't do it again. And you gave me one more chance, and I know I did it again, but if you'll give me one more chance, I promise you I won't do it again. You can play this game for the rest of your life. Guess what you're going to do? You're going to do it again. Now, that's not much confidence in that, is it? Even for good people. Law brings wrath. That's the downside of law. Because what is the penalty for transgression of law? Death. Death's a violent thing. And where there is no law, there is no transgression. Now, I don't know how far out on that plank you want to walk, but that's some deep water right there, folks. It's a self-evident truth. If there's no law, you can't transgress it, right? If you're not being justified by law, let it sink in, folks. Blessed is the man whose sin the Lord will never count against him. If law is not your avenue for being justified, and he says, where there is no law, there's no transgression. If law is not the basis of your salvation, how is he doing that? Because where there's law brings wrath, where there's no law, there's no transgression. Do you begin to see the nuts and bolts of how God is accomplishing this incredible new way of making you righteous? And you say, you don't say it, but you think it. That's kind of scary. I don't know if what you're saying is right. I hadn't really said anything. I'm just saying that the Bible says right here, where there is no law, there's no transgression. Therefore, the promise comes by faith. Well, I got lots of passages I'd like to plug in there and preach a while. Maybe we'll come back to it sometime, but... Therefore, the promise comes by faith, so that it may be, how? By grace. If it came by law, it could not be by grace. Do you understand that? Grace is what? Unearned, undeserved. It's not trying to be good enough. He says, the promise comes by faith. What is the promise? Well, the promise to Abraham, he'd be heir of the world. The promise has to do with being with God, being right with God. The promise comes by faith so that it may be by grace. and guaranteed to all of Abraham's offspring, not only those who are the law, but those who are of the faith of Abraham. He is the father of us all. It's coming together, folks, right here. Your righteousness is either by your effort or it is a gift. You can't have it both ways. The promise comes by faith so that it may be by grace. Your salvation is a matter of grace. It's not a matter of you earning it or being good enough or deserving it. And if you keep fighting that battle, you're fighting a losing battle. And you're losing out on both ends. You're going to lose out at the end, and you're losing out right now. Because when you quit trying to be good enough to go to heaven thinking you've got to do so, and you accept God's gift, you accept God's gift in reality in your life, it takes all the pressure off of you. Because you can't be good enough to go to heaven anyway. Don't you know that by now? Surely you know that by now. You're all grown people here. And we've been fighting that battle long enough. And it's taken the life out of us. And we haven't enjoyed being a Christian very much because we haven't had any security. And we've been pointing the finger at one another because if that person has some security and I don't really have any, I got to get his security away from him because he's just arrogant and I got to knock it out of him. And so we preach at one another and we point the finger at one another and we condemn one another. What's the deal? Why? Because we're insecure. But when you get secure about your salvation, you don't have to criticize anybody else. You can give a helping hand. But if you're not secure and God's going to grade on the curve, then you've got to kick everybody you can out of that top 10%. Because, you know, I mean, when he grades on the curve, it's only going to be the top 10% that's going to get in. And so if you look like you're doing real well, I've got to criticize you and get you out of that 10%. I mean, this answers a lot of things that go on interpersonal relationships here. And people's attitude. And the lack of confidence. And the hostility toward one another. This answers, I mean, this gets down to the bottom line right here. Of our relationships to one another and our relationship to God and our security and whether or not we're negative or whether we're happy or whether we're secure or whether we're insecure. It's all right here. He says, he is a father. Abraham, it might be guaranteed to all Abraham's offspring. Now, this things like guaranteed and promise and so forth, this is new kind of talk that we didn't see in 118 to 320, by the way. It might be guaranteed to all of Abraham's offspring, not only those who are the law, but those who are of the faith of Abraham. He's the father of us all. As I have written, I've made you father of many nations. Isn't it interesting that that little word was overlooked for so long by the Jews? He said, I've made you the father of many nations. Not just one, many nations. He is our father in the sight of God in whom he believed. The God who gives life to the dead and calls things that are not as though they were. I love that phrase. You got to read it 15 times to be able to say it right, you know. He is the God, this God that he's talking about. He gives life to the dead and he calls things that are not as though they were. Did Abraham have anything to do with God giving life to the dead? Think about it just a moment. When God told him to take that boy and put him on an altar and to offer him as a sacrifice. And Abraham's thinking about the fact that God said, this boy Ishmael, he was a mistake. Put that boy and his mother out. Let me take care of taking care of him, but you put him out. I told you that Sarah was going to have a son. And Abraham's thinking about this, and he loves that boy, Ishmael, but he sends him and his mother away. And so now it's all riding on one boy. This boy comes along, Isaac, right? And everything's riding on him. I mean, he's the one and only. There is no plan B. And he gets up to a certain age, and Abraham has cut off all any other possibilities that there might be. And God says, take this boy and kill him. And Abraham says, are you kidding me? The Bible didn't say he said that. But he said that, something like that. And he began to reason. How could this possibly be? God said, this is the boy. He made me cast Ishmael out. And he said, this is the boy through whom I'm going to bring all these promises about. And there's no plan B. And God promised me that this is the boy. And now he's telling me to kill him. How can this possibly be? And Hebrews says that Abraham reasoned, if I kill this boy, okay, I know what's going to happen. If I kill this boy, what's going to happen? God is going to bring him back to life. That's what Hebrews says, that he reasoned to that point. Now, is that trusting God? Man, that takes your breath away. I mean, it's one thing to read about it. But can you imagine being in that situation where God has put you in that bind? And then he says, take this boy and kill him. Could you do it? Be careful what you say. Don't you say no. You see, part of our problem is we put Abraham's faith up here on the pedestal as if it's something that we can't ever have. Folks, if you keep it there and you keep telling yourself that you can't have that level of faith, you might be in trouble. Because that's the kind of faith that God wants from you. That you trust Him in everything. Whether it makes any sense to you or not. This is the kind of faith. Now, we've already lost the possibility of being justified by law. Let me tell you something. Get real serious about being justified by faith. I mean, don't put it out there as if it's something you can't do. I mean, this is the last train. And it's a wonderful one. It's incredible. But you've got a part here. And your part is you've got to learn to trust God. I mean it, big time. You've got to learn to trust God. And quit leaning to your own understanding. Because you can't get there. He's already shown you that. You can't get there. And so, the promise comes by faith so that it may be by grace and it may be guaranteed. It's guaranteed. It's guaranteed. He'll do it. To all Abraham's offspring. Verse 17, he says, it is written, I've made you a father of many nations. He is our father in the sight of God in whom he believed, the God who gives life to the dead and calls things that are not as though they were. By the way, you know anything that was not, that God called it as if it were? The what?
The earth.
The earth. The earth. How about the cross? Revelation 13:8 says, the Lamb that was slain from the foundation of the world. God calls things that are not as though they were. You with me? And that's how back here in the Old Testament, whenever nobody could possibly see and understand this concept of imputed righteousness, that God forgave sins before the cross ever happened. Remember our little illustration when we got there to chapter 3, verse 21 to 31? All this time, whenever God was forgiving sins and he was taking some people to be with him and Satan screaming, you can't do that because I can prove that this guy Moses, that he's unrighteous, that he's a sinner. And God would say, just wait and see. When God said that, God could look down through time and see his son hanging on a cross. He didn't have to speculate on it. He didn't have to pretty much know it was going to happen. He could look down through time and see it. It was a reality. God is not limited by time. We're limited by time. We can have evidence that something's going to happen tomorrow, and we can make a good bet on it and feel pretty safe. But we don't know, do we? We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. But you know what? God doesn't have to wait till tomorrow to know what's going to happen tomorrow. Tomorrow is, in God's world, just like yesterday. It's just that certain. And so God, who's not limited by time, looked down through time and he saw his son hanging on the cross. And seeing his son hanging on the cross, he came back to the present time, whether it was Adam's time or Moses' time or Elisha's time, whoever's time it was, and he could act on that knowledge, even when nobody else could understand it. He's the God who calls things that are not as though they were. That's my God. That's your God. I like my God. Don't you? I mean, this is incredible. That he doesn't have to wait for it to happen in order to know it's going to happen. And you know what? That gives me lots of security, too. Because he's given me some promises about it. You know, if I'll trust him, there's certain things that he's going to bring about in my life. And if I love him, all things are going to work together for good. Well, if he already knows what things are going to happen in the future, then I'm pretty confident that he's going to be able to weave my life into a pattern that's going to cause things to be good. Aren't you? I like my God. And it took me a long time, but I like the way he's justified me. Because for the first time in my life, I've got some security. Because I tried to be good most of the time when I was young. I tried to be good. And it's easier for some people to be good than others. Okay? I won't tell you which one I am, but anyway, that's a fact. There's some people it's really hard for them to be good, and other people it's easier for them to be good, you know? But either one of them, it doesn't matter because there's bad in all of us, and we've all sinned. And so we're all in the same boat. And God makes us all the same offer, regardless of how wicked your past may have been. You got the same chance that I got. That's a neat deal. And you know who that's the hardest on? Self-righteous people. Because we have to give up our self-righteousness. An old boy out here who's really messed his life up, and he's just an obvious sinner, and everybody looks down on him, and he's vomiting in the gutter down here, you know. He's a little hard for him to have much self-righteous, but, you know, those of us who come to church and dress up nice and, you know, we kind of behave ourselves, it's hard for us to accept this. That's real, real interesting. God didn't come to save good people. He came to save sinners. You know that? And until you acknowledge and understand that you're a sinner, God can't help you. We're all in the same boat. So we'll stop right there, and we'll pick up. I wish I had finished chapter 4 with you, but we'll pick it up right there next time. Anybody, we want to have a prayer here? You got that phone call? Thank you for being here today.